Welcome to Europe Chats. We are recording in late March 2024 when the European Union is continuing its internal discussion how to go about enlargement. In the coming months, accession negotiations should start with Ukraine, Moldova and Bosnia and Herzegovina. The European Commission has made proposals for progressive integration of candidate countries so that their economies become stronger and more connected with the EU, even before formal accession. A 50 billion euro Ukraine facility was established a few weeks ago, and a 6 billion reform and growth facility for the Western Balkans should become operational soon. The Commission has also outlined what needs to be reconsidered in various EU policies so that they are fit for an enlarged union, and it is starting preparatory work on the next multi-annual financial framework. My guest today is a high-ranking official of the European Commission, Director General for Neighbourhood and Enlargement Negotiations, Gert-Jan Koopman. Mr. Koopman is very well known in Brussels. He worked on economic and competition policies, was in charge of the EU budget, and now he is busy with an ambitious agenda for strengthening integration between the EU and its neighbours. Welcome, Mr. Koopman.
Thank you very much for having me, Marianne.
Thank you for joining us. Do you personally believe that it is realistic that the EU enlarges in the next 10 years? And could you make a brief case on why should the EU actually enlarge?
Absolutely. Well, I think it is realistic, and I also personally think it will happen. Why is it important? Well, it's important, obviously, for the candidate countries, and that's always been the case. These countries feel part of the European family, and they want to benefit from all that the EU has to offer. But this time round, it is also particularly important for the EU27, for geostrategic and geopolitical reasons. The world we live in has become much more unstable, and these countries are all part of our neighbourhood. They're part of our family in many ways, and they would bring a lot to the EU27 as well. So this time round, I think it's more symmetrical than it was in the past. Having said that, of course, enlargement is hard work. It's a challenge. But with a lot of energy coming from both sides, I think we should be able to succeed.
When you hear people who are skeptical about Ukraine joining the EU after so much destruction, ongoing destruction from the war, what do you tell to them? What can Ukraine bring to the European Union? What opportunities do you see?
I tell them two things. One, Ukraine isn't going to be joining tomorrow, and we're putting in place a massive effort to help them get back on their feet economically. You already refer to the Ukraine facility, the 50 billion euros plan, which should help them grow out of this very difficult situation and build back better, actually preparing also a little bit for a future in the EU. So the Ukraine that will join is not the Ukraine you see on the television screens today. In terms of what it would bring a lot. It would bring Europe's strongest army, let us be honest about that. It would bring an agricultural superpower, which at the moment we see as a challenge, but in reality it's also a strength. It would bring an energy system that in the first weeks of the war was actually exporting electricity to the EU. We tend to forget that. Huge possibilities for gas storage, abundant natural resources. But beyond that, a young, dynamic population, a society that is very much opting to be a European society, full of bright young people who are developing sectors of the economy which, frankly speaking, are not so powerful in the EU today. Think about the IT industry. Look at what the war is forcing them to do in terms of innovations in drones. So I think there's a lot to benefit for the EU27 when they eventually join.
When the European Council decides to open accession negotiations, as with Ukraine and Moldova last December, or with Bosnia-Herzegovina just now, what happens then? How does the process look like?
Absolutely. Well, I don't want to make it too bureaucratic because it is a process that involves, in essence, let me simplify, in essence, it involves the countries taking over the EU corpus of legislation.
Famous acquis.
The famous acquis, and also reforming their societies to deal with what we call in enlargement speak the fundamentals, which is about the rule of law, democracy, that, of course, is really fundamental to what we are in Europe. So it's a period of intensive reforms, and they are organized in these accession negotiations based on a document which we call the negotiating framework, which sets out how we go about it, which, after having started with the discussions on the fundamentals, which I already mentioned, goes through a number of clusters that characterize this entire corpus of legislation, the acquis. These chapters are opened when certain conditions are fulfilled, and they're closed once all of the necessary reforms have been done. Given the importance we attach to the fundamentals, we, under our new methodology, we open with the fundamentals cluster, and it's only once we start closing the fundamentals cluster that we can close the rest in terms of the negotiations. When that is done, in essence, the member states individually, collectively, it's a decision by unanimity, need to decide that the country is ready for enlargement, and the European Parliament needs to give consent. In the past, we've seen some member states deliberating on this for quite a bit. There is the possibility that in some of these countries, a referenda will be called. So the end game is deeply political, and also one where the national audiences in each and every member state play a big role.
Well, that's a very good point. Aren't you sometimes afraid that this process can get stuck at so many levels if one or more member state decides not to go forward with the enlargement file?
Yes, I think we need to be honest. It is not a straightforward process, and there are challenges. But I also believe that we have been able in the past to demonstrate that if we really want it, we can do it, and we can do it quickly. It's useful to refer back to the Big Bang enlargement of 2004 when 10 countries joined the EU. Okay, the acquis was a lot smaller then than it is today, but it went very fast, and there was strong motivation on both sides. I sometimes jokingly say that we need to replicate the spirit of the 2004 cohort now in the 2020s.
You spoke a lot about fundamentals. Can you perhaps give a concrete example of fundamentals of state functioning that a candidate has successfully improved during the negotiations in recent years?
Yes. Well, I mean, the fight against corruption, which in many of our candidate countries used to be pretty deeply embedded, is a very good test case. Without robust anti-corruption policies, without changing the way societies and economies work in this regard, enlargement is very hard to imagine, let us be honest. So one example I could mention is that of Albania, which is going through the vetting of all of its judges and prosecutors to check whether they are tainted by corruption or whether there are issues of probity. This process is nearing an end and has led to about 60% of judges and prosecutors stepping down. So it shows you the power in terms of transforming an entire critical sector of society, of the enlargement process. And it's very much also what's happening in Moldova and in Ukraine, with a lot of international scrutiny of appointments in this sector, with vetting commissions involving external experts. You see the fruits of this process already in Moldova and Ukraine. A number of very significant high-level corruption cases have been unearthed, prosecuted, and convicted. So the process works.
Yes, the EU's transformative power works.
That's it.
So from this year onwards, the EU will have new financing mechanisms that will be very closely linked to reforms, and namely the Ukraine Facility and the Western Balkans Reform and Growth Facility. How will this support be connected to the accession negotiations, and what will be different as compared to the pre-accession financing?
Absolutely. Well, these are modern generation of budgetary tools, which we implemented in the EU not so very long ago. Think about Next Generation EU and the Recovery and Resilience Facility. In essence, these are performance-based instruments. So you are paid not for the costs that you incur in doing something, but for achieving results. And this is the logic of the Ukraine plan. It's also the logic of the Western Balkans Growth Facility. So what we are doing is defining very clear reforms, which are broken down in steps. And on the basis of indicators, we measure whether these steps are attained. And money only flows if that is the case. It's a very different logic, incentivizing reforms and using the proceeds also, especially in the case of the Western Balkans Growth Facility, to pay for investments that are necessary. Some of the reforms are absolutely fundamental for growth, but they're also critical when it comes to the enlargement process. And these are some of the fundamentals that we have already discussed a little bit. So they will be part of the growth plan because they're essential for growth, but they're also preconditions, hard preconditions for enlargement. So that's where you have the link.
Okay, thank you for that very, very clear explanation. Now, one perhaps slightly difficult question, and it's about the farmers in Europe. So farmers have been protesting across the EU for a few weeks now. They are triggered by many things, including the costs of the environmental measures. But very often these protests get caricatured as if they were all about Ukraine. Now, in reality, there is a lot, like massive volumes of Russian grain that is entering or being sold in Europe and in the rest of the world without any restrictions. That is obviously bringing down the prices. Can't the EU institutions manage these agricultural tensions better? Also to reassure European farmers that their future is not really threatened by Ukraine. And how do we build popular support for enlargements if difficult, you know, cases or issues like this don't get adequately tackled in European public debate? I'm asking this because I fear that if EU institutions or EU representatives don't tell the story, citizens will mainly hear disinformation.
No, it's a very good question and one that hits home quite hard. Tomorrow, our offices will be closed because the farmers will be blocking the Rue de la Loi again. So it's a very tangible and real experience for many of us. But as you said, Marianne, it's not principally about Ukraine. It's a whole series of factors that affects farmers. And the protests are therefore quite diffuse in terms of their objectives. What is very unfortunate, and there I agree with you, is that misinformation, and probably a lot of this is coming from Russia indeed, has conjured up the image of Ukrainian grain flooding the internal market and undercutting EU 27 farmers. We can demonstrate that this is factually incorrect. All of this grain actually is in transit and exported to third countries. So we need, I think, to be much more robust in dispelling these myths, these falsehoods, I should say, and much clearer in our communication. And this goes, in my view, well beyond this particular instance. I think enlargement in the 2020s will be a very different experience in our own societies in the 27 than enlargement in the 2000s, when there was a significant consensus, I think, amongst basically all participants. This is no longer the case. We live in a world where there is polarization. There are actors who have an interest in undermining, torpedoing this process. And there are genuine concerns out there about bringing in up to 9 new countries at a time where, you know, one of them is engaged in active warfare. Two have Russian troops on their territory. I'm talking about Georgia. I don't have to explain this to you, but the same is true for Moldova. And the situation in the Western Balkans is one where tensions flare up regularly, and many of us remember the war in the 1990s. So in this environment, I think the EU cannot afford to neglect communication and to be much more outspoken, much clearer and braver to take part in these public debates in the member state.
Mm-hmm. I have read the recent Commission communication on pre-enlargement policy reviews. The Commission announces that it will only start its internal policy reviews in early 2025. At the same time, in the press, we read that many EU leaders are trying to avoid the enlargement topic before the EP elections because they fear that too much talk on enlargement will drive votes towards far-right groups. But instead, should the EU representatives and governments not try to explain to citizens the benefits that previous enlargement has brought and future enlargement will bring?
Yeah, no, listen, I think communication is central, and we need to take a much more active role as EU institutions. Having said that, I don't believe that it would be sensible to turn these European elections, you know, 3 months from now, less than 3 months from now, into elections about enlargement, because that is not really the question that is on the table today. I think what is needed is a much more sustained effort over a much longer period of time, because the decisions on enlargement will have to be taken a few years down the road. For me, there are two important issues. One is the debates are actually very different in the different member states. I discovered, much to my surprise, that a key debate in the Baltics is about the EU forcing Baltic citizens to eat insects. Can you believe this?
Oh.
When I heard that, I thought this cannot be true. But in fact, this is a debate that is motivated by the fact that there is EU legislation that codifies when, you know, insects can be used in a safe way for protein in foods. So this is essentially our internal market legislation that is an enabling legislation. There's no mandatory eating of insects, obviously. But a myth like that can have a huge and deleterious effect on the public environment and the mood in a country. And it, as I said, is a very specific debate in a specific country. So the discussions in the Netherlands and France are likely to be very different from those in Poland and the Czech Republic. So we need to differentiate, and we need to understand the nature of the debates in the member states. First point. Second point, you know, we need to be honest about this. It's not a good idea to come and throw out a bunch of macroeconomic statistics, although I'm a macroeconomist by trade. I like to do that, so I have to stop myself from time to time. But, you know, there are sometimes winners and losers, and there are challenges in enlargement. And we need to be honest about that. If you're a small trading nation, like the country I know best, the Netherlands, you'll benefit more than if you're a big closed economy with a lot of sectors that are likely to, you know, be in competition with sectors in newly acceding member states. I still believe there will be benefits ultimately for everyone if we manage the process intelligently. But we need to be open to such concerns and address them. Some of these concerns are imagined, and we need to explain that they're imagined, and what we're doing to expose those falsehoods is very important. Others are real and need to be addressed, and we have tools in the toolkit to do so. But unless we have such a more differentiated and more honest conversation with much more resources being put into it over the next years, I fear that at the very end of the process, when national governments need to decide and you may have referenda, we may stumble and enlargement may not take place. So for me, this is actually a top priority.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for pointing that out. We actually have published recently a book on national positions on enlargement. And authors from our member institutes have contributed to that. So that's a very, very important point, of course, that different countries perceive different threats differently, and they also perceive enlargement very differently. But do you think there is a common story that the European Union can put forward in terms of enlargement?
Well, listen, I think it only takes a regular visit to Warsaw over a period of 20 years or to the Baltics to see what the power of enlargement is in terms of transforming societies and economies, especially if you then compare it with countries that did not escape from the Iron Curtain. And, you know, if you compare Belarus to Poland, the story tells itself. So for the new countries, for the new member states, the benefits are so significant, there is no doubt about it. But for our member states, the old member states, there are also huge benefits. When I was still Director General of DG Budget, I had a lot of fun teasing my compatriots by pointing out that the royalties and dividends pay to Dutch multinationals only from the Czech Republic, which became the workhorse, really, of manufacturing industry in the EU following enlargement, that those flows of funds were larger than the entire net contribution that the Dutch have paid into the EU budget. So, you know, countries tend to benefit from a much larger internal market, and they tend to benefit from the possibility to diversify. But I think we should also talk about the citizens, ordinary people. We, you know, my kids, they basically cannot remember what it was like to have border controls, checks in the EU. But this is not so long ago, right? So the ease of travel, the facility with which we can live in other countries, we can study wherever we want, we can buy and trade wherever we want in the EU, that is a huge benefit, which we need to remind ourselves of from time to time, because, you know, you cannot really take it for granted. So there are economic advantages, there are undoubtedly huge advantages in terms of the quality of life for EU 27 citizens. And finally, and I think this is very important in the 2020s, we will be a bigger, more relevant, more secure, and stronger bloc in a world that is not particularly friendly. We have an interest to strengthen ourselves. This is not really the way we looked at it 20 years ago when we had the last big enlargement. But, you know, we are an economic superpower. The EU is undoubtedly the largest internal market in the world. We're not yet geopolitically a superpower. And if I can say, with the Balkans in and anchored in the EU, Georgia, Moldova, and Ukraine members, we will be a very different union.
Well, for many years, the enlargement process was held back by the view that EU had limited ability to absorb new members. In light of Russia's war against Ukraine, member states have become more willing to consider different solutions to the EU's own functioning so that it can actually function effectively with more than 30 member states. The Belgian presidency is currently reflecting on possible changes in the Council's decision-making, including greater use of qualified majority voting. What will these debates lead, in your view? What conclusions can you imagine?
Yeah. Well, let me say this debate about absorption capacity, in reality, very often hides a debate about the need to adjust some of our policies irrespective of enlargement. And sometimes it's convenient to say, well, you have to do this for enlargement, right? In fact, we have to do it anyway. We know that. So we should not unnecessarily confound the two. This enlargement, the nine countries that are out there, is a smaller enlargement in terms of numbers of people, in terms of the size of the economies we would be integrating, than the Big Bang enlargement of 20 years ago. So we managed then. This is actually easier, economically speaking. Now, decision-making is indeed an issue. And I personally believe, this is not an institutional view, it's my personal view, that indeed we have to look at this carefully. And indeed there are means of doing so under the existing treaties, which I think we should explore. Having said that, you know, I remember very well when we were 12 and we were talking about enlargement and we had exactly the same debate. It would be impossible. There would be no time to even speak. You know, the choir pair would come to an end. The world as we knew it would cease to exist. This could never work. In reality, you know, a lot of decisions are taken by unanimity and we're quite effective. And for anyone who claims that the EU is dysfunctional when it comes to decision making, I kindly ask them to look across the pond at the US and to look at how decisions are taken these days in a system that votes by majorities, but that seems to be gridlocked over most important issues. So yes, we need to do a lot of reforms. We probably should do them anyway, irrespective of enlargement, but we can do a lot without those reforms as well, and we should not shy away from doing it.
We have discussed the efforts of the candidate countries. We have discussed the EU's support to them and its own preparations for enlargement. Now, I think that one important dimension is generally overlooked in the EU's enlargement policy, and that is the security of candidate countries. Can the EU realistically expect democratic institutions to flourish in the neighborhood while Russia is working relentlessly to thwart any such ambitions? Can the accession process achieve intended results as long as the EU and the candidate countries do not manage jointly to neutralize the Russian threats?
Yes, I think this is part of the challenges of this generation when it comes to enlargement. I think we need to invest in societies that are much more resilient. And this is not just a matter of addressing misinformation, false narratives. I think it requires very robust responses. And, you know, if I look at Moldova, what it is being exposed to in terms of, in essence, Russian influences affecting the stability of the state, if I can use that term, then you see that this is absolutely essential. But again, modern states can equip themselves in a way that is fully compatible with EU rules, with mechanisms to defend themselves. And I think that is a conversation we didn't have 20 years ago. It's a conversation we need to have today. And we are actually having today, because we cannot have a system where we're undermined by a third actor in terms of the core competences and features of functioning countries in our union. So I see that as a challenge, but a challenge we can definitely succeed.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Koopman, for your insights. Thank you for clarifying so many important aspects on enlargement, and I wish you all the best in your very important mission.
Thank you very much. Pleasure being here.
And thank you all for watching. We will come back with further episodes of Europe Chat on enlargement. Stay with us.
This podcast is co-funded by the European Union. The views and opinions expressed are, however, those of the authors only and do not necessarily reflect those of the European Union or the European Education and Culture Executive Agency. Neither the European Union nor the granting authority can be held responsible for them.